Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. The rising cost of housing has been a challenge around Charlotte for years as the city struggles to balance growth and affordability. You've seen it if you've tried to rent an apartment or buy a house anytime in the past decade or so, but this problem isn't new. In his new book, Affordable Housing in Charlotte, What One City's History Tells Us About America's Pressing Problem, historian Tom Hanchett explores the history of housing in Charlotte. Hanchett examines how housing policies at all levels of government have trickled down to the local level to impact the shape of our city. With all of the focus around the problems about affordable housing, it can seem intractable or even maybe a bit hopeless. But Hanchett thinks that shining a light on these problems and the many, many solutions that have been tried with varying degrees of success might help us figure out some better ideas today. Tom Hanchett, welcome to the show.
Good to be here on WFAE.
So some people hear affordable housing in Charlotte and think, boy, that's an oxymoron right now. How did you know you would find enough of it, affordable housing in Charlotte, to fill a book?
Well, it surprised me. And you say it doesn't seem like there's very much at all. One of the reactions I got as I was working on the book was people would say, you're doing a book about affordable housing in Charlotte. That's going to be a mighty short book. But I would have guessed maybe from public housing in the 20s and 30s and 40s all the way up to the present, I would have guessed maybe 30, 40, 50 apartment complexes, something like that. 150 are up and running right now. There's another 30 or so that I found that are no longer affordable housing or no longer extant. But there's a lot more affordable housing in Charlotte than most of us know, partly because a lot of it is very good, blends in very well with the surrounding neighborhoods. And so that was one of the big surprises of working on the book.
So why did you decide to focus a book on affordable housing in Charlotte? Aside from, you know, you living in Charlotte and knowing this city probably better than just about anybody, why focus on this topic in a city like Charlotte when there's bigger projects, bigger affordable housing developments, more famous ones in bigger cities?
Well, Charlotte is, no city is really typical, but Charlotte is a mid-sized city. We've been growing a great deal, which puts us in a special category. But actually, urban historians, which I would count myself as one, have typically focused on Chicago, on New York, and wonderful places. But there's a lot more places like Charlotte. And so I was here. I wanted to understand my own city. But I think the book is going to find an audience far beyond Charlotte.
So before we get too far into this conversation, let's try to settle on a definition. What is affordable housing?
Oh, boy, that's the question I get when I go out and talk to folks. That's the very first one. There are two parts of the answer that I give. One is that rule of thumb, and it's been in place for decades and decades and decades, rule of thumb, you shouldn't be spending more than about 30% of your income on housing. That includes your rent or your house payment, but also utilities, things like that. And so that 30%, keep that in mind. The other half of the answer is affordable for whom? And they're roughly the lower half of the income spread. Folks who are making the area median income or less than the area median income, particularly two categories, folks who are making 30% of area median income, really ultra low income folks, folks who are making 60% of area median income. Both of those now need subsidized housing. 30% of area median income, that might be custodians, that might be folks who are living with disabilities, that might be food service workers, childcare workers.
Yeah, and to put some concrete dollar numbers on that, I believe in the most recent numbers I've seen, it's around $23,000 for a family of four. So that's, you know, pretty low. And if right. you're only going to take 30% of that for housing, it doesn't leave you with a lot of options.
Yeah. 60% surprises people. That is folks that had basically chosen a career that we need, but is not very remunerative. Police officer trainees, last time I checked, teachers for sure, nurse assistants, social workers, all of those folks are now finding it really hard to find a place to live in Charlotte.
So your previous book, Sorting Out the New South City, traced the evolution of Charlotte from a fairly, I would say, even surprisingly integrated city at the dawn of the 20th century to a very segregated city along racial lines as the years went on. This new book, Affordable Housing in Charlotte, I think it also focuses on where people live and where they are not allowed to live, but based on economic lines, not strictly racial lines. How did you land on, I would say, kind of the same topic, but through a different lens? And what connections do you see to your first book?
Well, the first book was called Sorting Out the New South City, and it's how Charlotte became a big city, but also how it became a segregated city, not only on the basis of race and ethnicity, but also on the basis of income. And thing that may be in your head if you've been in Charlotte for a while is a map of Mecklenburg County called the Crescent and Wedge Map, where there's a wedge of wealth extending southward, kind of down the Providence Road corridor, but much wider than that. That wedge of wealth is counterbalanced by the crescent of much less wealth from the airport to Johnson C. Smith University to Central Avenue on the east side. And those two Charlottes, it's really easy to kind of be in your bubble in Charlotte, to assume that what's in front of you every day as you go to work, go to church, go to school, go to the gym, is Charlotte. And so understanding how that came to be, that was the first book. With affordable housing, where do we put affordable housing? Do we put it in areas where there are already a lot of low-income people? Do we put it in areas where there is high income and often high opportunity? The folks who need those good jobs may not live in the part of Charlotte where the good jobs are. And it helped in 2014 that Raj Chetty, a noted scholar from, I think at that time, Berkeley, but now at Harvard, did this study about opportunity in the 50 largest metro areas in the United States. Charlotte, which you would think would do really well at that. We got a new airport. We got, new sports teams. We got a new skyline. Came out 50th out of 50. And if you talk to Chetty, that segregation, that splitting of American cities, particularly Charlotte, into areas of wealth and areas of not wealth is really at the root of how hard it is for somebody at the bottom of the economic ladder to make it to the top.
Yeah, and that, I think, highlights why housing and housing policy is so interesting to write about and read about, for me anyway. It's really, I think, the everything story, where you live influences where you go to school, what kind of job you have, what peers you have, and ultimately the course of your whole life. So it's really foundational.
Indeed.
So you start your book with a section of six myths, three hard truths, and two surprising ironies. I did some advanced math, and I think that's 11 things. So we don't have to go through them all, but what are some of those myths in particular that you found that maybe surprised you as you dug into this topic?
Well, myth number one in my list here, Charlotte never does anything about affordable housing. And discovering those 150 apartment complexes that are low income, mixed income, wow, it's much more than you might expect. The worry that folks often have that affordable housing will happen next to them is one of the things that the book really attacks. And by knowing that there is an affordable housing development right across the street from South Park Mall, which has not seen its property values degrade, that there are affordable housing developments on Providence Road, which is, as we said, one of the most desirable parts of Charlotte, really helps you understand that. And then another thing that that was part of my journey was the sense that, well, homeless people are just not working. You know, if they just got a job. And Dale Mullinex, who ran what is now Roof Above, the homeless shelter in Charlotte several years ago, said, last night in our men's homeless shelter, half of the men have jobs, full-time jobs. And so affordable housing is you know, you can't just assume that what you know and what you see in front of you defines the problem.
And I want to read one of the hard truths that you highlight here, which is, as you write, the private market can do it better, or government can do it better. Americans have moved back and forth in their thinking. The reality, history shows that neither is the magic bullet. And I think for me, that highlighted something about this affordable housing narrative of a crisis that we've seen, which is, if you have a crisis, if you have a problem, as we describe it, that implies that there's a solution. There's something, one thing that can solve it. And if we just did X, we'd be solved. And, you know, you have some people who highlight the need to build more housing and say, remove all the regulations and it'll be solved. You have some people who think that the government should spend massively more and it would be solved. But your book really traces the history of trying all kinds of different approaches like that, and they all have some downsides and create problems of their own. Big picture, what do you think about the framing of this crisis narrative that we've, myself included, really absorbed and talked about a lot in the media, of this as a crisis rather than a chronic condition?
That is a wonderful way of thinking about this, and I'm really appreciative that you put it that way. It is a crisis. We have folks living in tents. If you stop at the stoplight, not only the guys with the signs, men and women now, which is a new thing, but if you drive slowly or have somebody else drive and you look out the window, you'll see that there are tent camps all over Charlotte. And so, this is a real problem, and it is a problem that has been around as long as this book covers, which is 80 years. We have figured out things that do work, and be happy to go into some of those in detail. But because there are different kinds of needs, because the economy is always changing, because the real estate markets evolve, I don't think we're ever going to find the one thing. But the hope, I think, that comes out of this book, Affordable Housing in Charlotte, is that there are tools that have produced and are producing some good places right among us right now.
And when you look back on those 80 years that you cover here, we'll talk more about what works and what doesn't, and what solutions you found that create problems of their own. But I wanted to ask, how did you actually compile a list of all these housing projects and housing developments? Because that's a lot of research.
Man, you know, I figured the grown-ups would have done this already. And you know, I'm close to 70 years old. It turns out I'm one of the grown-ups, and I hadn't done it. Fortunately, the newspapers are now online. And if you have keywords and nothing better to do, you can keep pumping the keywords in. And piece by piece, I found that list of 150 affordable complexes in Charlotte.
When we return, more on the history of affordable housing in Charlotte, what lessons we might learn from that development, and the surprisingly recent struggle to implement universal indoor plumbing. That's next on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
And this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eli Portillo, in today for Mike Collins. Our guest is Dr. Tom Hanchett, a historian and the author of Affordable Housing in Charlotte, a new book detailing a pressing problem that affects not just our city, but most places in the U.S. So, Tom, one thing that I think you and your book do really well is paint a picture of what Charlotte has looked like over different points in its history. Let's go back to the start of your narrative. What was Charlotte like 80 plus years ago at the start of your book? And how was affordable housing thought of? Was that really a concept that people even talked about and had back then?
Well, if you define affordable housing today as housing that is in some way subsidized, didn't exist. If you go back to the 1920s, 1930s, this was a city where every neighborhood had naturally occurring affordable housing. The shorthand for that in the housing world is NOA, not the guy with the big boat, but naturally occurring affordable housing. And I spend a chapter looking at how that was woven into every neighborhood. I live in Plaza Midwood. In the block that I'm in, there's a four-unit quadruplex, a couple of two-unit duplexes, houses that eventually had filtered down and were rental houses. And so that was the normal thing. You even find it in Myers Park, very
yeah,
well.
I lived for about a decade in Dilworth in for a while, quadplex, and then in a duplex. So I've got a lot of experience with that myself.
So the notion of mixing that into a city was pretty normal. Folks who had the least economic oomph tended to be absentee landlords would pick an area, often a pretty small area that in Dilworth, for instance, there are textile mill houses near the Atherton Mill development, which is today fancy retail, but back in the day was a textile mill. And so African-American neighborhoods, the Brooklyn neighborhood in the center city, had lots of rental housing. But generally, it was mixed in. Even in a neighborhood like Brooklyn, you would have a homeowner, a business, and then you go around the block and you would have rental housing. So that notion that housing could be everywhere, if we talk about the natural market before government got involved, that's what it looked like. And so that was an interesting starting point.
And I think in some ways, you know, we kind of a lot of urbanist folks idealize that era today when things were mixed in and there was denser development and there were quadplexes next to owner-occupied little, you know, manses. What were some of the downsides, though, of that in Charlotte's history?
Well, a key one was this thing about bathrooms. And indoor plumbing, we now take for granted that it's everywhere and that we absolutely have to have it because lack of sanitation will breed disease for all of us. It took a long time for that to become part of what we accepted. Back in the day, early 20th century, plumbing had been around for quite a while. Middle class, upper class people had plumbing, indoor plumbing. But poorer folks would use a privy, outdoor pit toilet. That's kind of nasty, particularly in the winter when everything freezes over, or
yeah,
in the summer when the mosquitoes and the flies are lighting there, and then, you know, where do they light next?
And that is one of the chapters in your book that I found really surprising because, you know, I'm not from Charlotte, but I've lived here for a while. And if you asked me when did people and where did people in this community have privies instead of indoor plumbing, I would have said, well, probably like, I don't know, 150 years ago and probably way out in the country. But
yeah,
this was recent and in Charlotte
yeah,
proper.
And it took a long time to get to everybody being mandated to have indoor plumbing. Camp Green, the World War I camp, almost did not locate here because we had so much of that disease-carrying kind of sanitation, lack of sanitation. Women's clubs campaigned in the 1930s. Men who ran things didn't listen to them very much. A tremendous pushback. It's socialism. People don't really want indoor plumbing. You'll have to raise the rents, and it'll just... arguments that you hear a lot about any kind of public investment in anything, any kind of regulation.
That was one quote that you found from a landlord in, I believe, the 1930s who said, referencing indoor plumbing, people don't want it and they couldn't pay for it if they did.
Yeah.
Which, you know, strikes our ears now as kind of absurd.
Yeah. And the turning point was in the 1940s, the polio epidemic. Folks slowly figuring out that, which would paralyze kids, and you grow up with stunted limbs and just awful things. Charlotte literally shut down for a couple of summers. It was like COVID, where it wouldn't let the kids out because this polio thing was going around. And they finally figured out that it was spread by flies and mosquitoes on human waste. And
yeah, that water contamination from those open privies seems kind of obvious in retrospect.
Yeah, but that was a new thing, and the real estate leaders who had been really against any sort of government regulation did a 180, which is really cool. They created something called the Realtor Standard House Ordinance, which required that you have indoor plumbing, window screens, things like that to keep the flies out. And they campaigned for it, and they made it happen. And that is when Charlotte got a real building code. There are still parts of it that took a long time to supplement, having heat that worked. It did not come to the 1970s.
And it's worth highlighting that there is now a push to mandate air conditioning in all residential units. Right. I believe there are still about 7,000 that don't have air conditioning due to being grandfathered in under the old code. So, you know, that's 80 years since this plumbing fight. Now we're talking about air conditioning, and you hear a lot of the similar arguments.
Right.
What are the lessons or parallels that you draw from this plumbing fight and affordable housing today? What can we see besides just kind of the, wow, I can't believe that was actually a debate?
Well, it is something that I come back to at the end of the book, because the pushback for expanding affordable housing opportunities often uses that same language that basically boils down to, it's not my problem, it's those people's problem, and I don't want to be regulated, I don't want to have my tax dollars going to them. And what we're realizing is that affordable housing in Charlotte and every big city is in a shortage, and that hurts. For instance, I talked recently with one of the HR people at the hospitals, and they said, we're trying to recruit nurses. We can only pay so much, but they're having a hard time finding a place to live in Charlotte. You know, we're building a medical college. We're expanding our hospitals, and the key person who provides care, they're worried. Same thing with CMS.
Yeah, that's why teachers. They're actually partnering with developers to try to build basically housing that is subsidized for educators. I think they're calling it an teacher village. And yeah. I think when you get that, okay, now it's affecting everyone, not just some people, that's when you often see movement towards solutions.
And I'm hopeful. I'm interested to notice that the big tax bill that is tax and budget bill that is being debated in Washington includes a small provision. It's too small, but it's a start. Something that was introduced bipartisan as the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, and it would increase the number of tax credits available for building low-income housing. Republicans like it. Democrats like it. That's when change really can start to happen.
So we've talked about the early years when it was just kind of laissez-faire. When did government start getting involved in building, financing, and supporting housing? And what did that look like in Charlotte when it started?
Well, the beginnings of that is public housing. And public housing happens in the Great Depression, when so many people are losing their houses, when there are tent cities on the edge of our metro areas called Hoovervilles, because the president wasn't doing very much, Herbert Hoover. And so this notion that government could, federal government could provide a loan to a community, the community put in some tax dollars. Most of the loan got paid back by rents, low-income folks renting those units in public housing. And in Charlotte, Fairview Homes, this is the era of segregation, black development on Oaklawn Avenue, Piedmont Courts, white development just off of Central Avenue. And so that public housing thing is the beginning of government involvement. It was much better than the poor folks' housing that existed. For one thing, it had indoor plumbing. It had roofs.
It's always a good
kept
thing.
The water out. Not something you're guaranteed with absentee landlords in the private market. And so the public housing was a step up, but it was done as cheaply as possible. Hundreds of units at the far edge of town, because land was cheap and it was hard to generate community in a place that there were no stores, there were no churches, there were no bars. It was hard to get to a job because it was multiple bus rides from the edge of town. And public housing was not built in a way that, well, it looked like public housing. It was not a place that gave you the warmth of home. Folks did create home and warmth and helping networks in public housing, but it was against the architectural odds. And so public housing in some ways a great step forward, but also when today I think we think of affordable housing, we think about the bare bones barracks, big concentrations of really economically desperate people. And that's not the affordable housing we're doing now, and it hasn't been for decades.
So what shifted, what changed, and when did that change start to happen?
I'll just pick out a couple of points because we could be here all day. I'm talking history. I'm having a great time. One key moment is in the late 1960s, 1970s, early 1980s, something called scattered site housing. And the impetus for this comes out of the civil rights movement. A lawsuit filed in Chicago said instead of segregating economically and racially, segregating folks in these big developments, we need to really scatter them all over the city. And Chicago didn't do very much of that, despite the lawsuit. But the folks in Charlotte really took that and ran with it. In the late 70s, early 80s, we had dozens of these small apartment complexes, looked like every other apartment complex, maximum of 50 units. And there's one called Gladedale on Providence Road. At Old Providence Road, you would have no idea. And so that notion of mixing people in was a powerful thing. And over time, in the last 30 years or so, that has become state of the art. Mixed income, mixing market rate, and other kinds of things. And we're, like I said, we've got more of them than you might imagine, just not enough.
So I think it's worth pausing for a second here and just describing how affordable housing, subsidized housing, is built today, because it's a complicated little beast, right?
Oh, yeah. One surprise that just blew me away was that we have not seen any increase in public housing since 1998. And that was because of the Faircloth Amendment. Conservative senator from North Carolina, Locke Faircloth, passed an amendment to national housing laws, said you cannot build any net gain in public housing. And population's gone up, needs gone up. And so, public housing expanding is not really the viable tool right at the moment. Instead, we have something that was introduced during the Reagan administration, affordable housing tax credits, a low-income housing tax credit.
LIHTC.
LIHTC, yep. And basically what it does is it uses the old tax shelter idea, which has its own interesting history, where an investor puts up money to build affordable apartments. They can give that money to a nonprofit like Dream Key Partners in Charlotte, or they can do it directly themselves. And they get a tax break. They get a break sheltering other income. And if you look today, there are things that supplement that, like the Charlotte Housing Trust Fund. But basically, if it's low-income housing, mixed-income housing today, it's built on the low-income housing tax credit.
And there are not enough of those currently to go around, right? There's a competitive process, and a large number of projects that are proposed don't end up winning those tax credits and you know, sometimes linger around, sometimes just bite the dust, right?
Yeah. If you go down the light rail to the Scaly Bark station, there's all sorts of new development there. The hope had been that that would be mixed income housing. A developer here in Charlotte put together a package proposal at his own expense. That's the way it works. Submitted it to the state. The state said, man, this is great. But we have very limited federal tax credits, and we just can't fund everything good that's coming out of Charlotte. And wow. And he put it in again the next year, put it in again the next year, and it kept almost making it. And it's because it's a tax break, and so the U.S. Treasury Department doesn't want to give those out willy-nilly. But we have a lot more good proposals on the table that could go right now than we have tax credit availability.
And I think that kind of highlights some of the, you know, idea that there's no single, hey, this is a magic bullet. Like, okay, we're not building the big barracks anymore. Now we have this process, which produces, I think you could fairly say, higher quality, better outcome communities, but it takes a really long time. It's really complicated, and there's not enough tax credits to go around. There's always a downside to every one of the solutions people try. It's, I was going to say it's like a Rubik's Cube, but I'm not sure that makes sense.
It does require special expertise, special wanting to do this. It's a big risk to put together something like that and then have it not funded. I expected, as I was working on Affordable Housing in Charlotte, the new book, that I would find, you know, bad people who didn't care or were trying to rip off the system or whatever. And every once in a while, there are some kind of iffy characters in the book. But basically, it is unwillingness at the federal level to really put the money in that is going to move the ball down the field.
And that's Tom Hanchett talking about his new book, Affordable Housing in Charlotte. After the break, we'll talk more about what solutions might work to help with this problem here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo, in this morning for Mike Collins, talking today with Dr. Tom Hanchett, local historian, author, and bluegrass player. He does that too, about his new book, Affordable Housing in Charlotte. So when we ended right before the break, you were mentioning how there weren't really villains you uncovered in your book. And I think that's somewhat of a contrast with some of the other books in the last decade or so that have really been influential and highlighted discussions about housing, urban development, affordability, and discrimination. I'm thinking here of Evicted and Color of Law, which, you know, really, excuse me, highlighted bad actors. Why didn't you take that approach, and what did you find that was different?
I admire those books. I really admire a new one by a guy named Brian Goldstone that is called There's No Place for Us Here. It's looking at Atlanta and looking at people who are homeless and working in America. And that was something, as I mentioned earlier, that is true here in Charlotte. Folks who are in those tent cities, folks who are in the overnight shelters, folks who are sleeping on somebody else's couch or in a motel by the week, they're among us. They're part of who we are. So I would love to tell that kind of first-person story, and I've got some cool little first-person stories in the book here. But I'm really curious about the interplay of big forces, the federal government, the state housing finance agency, the local policy decisions, and how how those interact on the ground in the real world. And it is It's part of the story. And I hope people pick this up. There's nothing like it else in the United States looking at that on the ground kind of case study approach.
Yeah. And I think that that is something, you know, when you look at those systems, I think none of them were designed with any sort of, you know, malice or idea, hey, we're deliberately not going to do enough or we're deliberately going to stymie this. But every move contains a downside as well as a positive. And there's no single thing, because if there was, we hopefully would have found it by now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've studied this, looked at 80 years of history in Charlotte. What do we know doesn't work? And what do we know that does?
Well, one of the things is the way that people build community wherever they are. And for a long time, folks looked at the old public housing and said, that's bad housing. There's nothing here that's good for people. And so in the 1990s, there was a national program called Hope 6 that gave federal money to tear down the old public housing projects. There's only one left still in Charlotte, Southside Homes, and build something new in mixed income. And the new mixed income stuff has worked really well. You find it in First Ward, you find it on Oaklawn Avenue, you find it all over the city. But in the process, it disrupted a lot of communities. And so being able to listen to the folks that you're trying to help, that's kind of a duh, but it really isn't, because in America, we love experts. We used to love them even more coming out of World War II, where the generals had led us to victory. One of my heroes in this book that I didn't know before, a guy named Charles Woodyard, who African-American, CEO of what's now in Livian, the Charlotte Housing Authority. And he was part of the Hope 6 demolition thing. And he says, I think I understand the human psychology behind it, but I was going through it and immersed in it, and I didn't understand it. I saw these communities, these big public housing projects, I saw those as artificial communities that the government had created to trap us. That's really the way I saw it. But African Americans who lived there did not see it that way. They saw it as their community. It took me a while to understand that. And so that's one of the lessons that comes out of the book. Another is the way that you need people at all different levels of government. You need people outside. You need journalists. Pam Kelly here in Charlotte, Daniel Jemtob, a fellow named Eli Portillo, kept writing these stories, Fred Klass and Kelly, that helped people who weren't in the middle of the problem to see that, yes, they were connected to the problem. And so that was really powerful. It helped, I think, that we've been passing $50 million bond issues every 2 years for about the last 5 or 6 years. Mayor Vi Lyles is one of the reasons for that. And she is a relatively quiet person for a mayor, doesn't toot her horn as much as she might. But she has been involved in affordable housing issues since she was a low-level government employee in the budget office. Helped put together what's now Dream Key Partners, the big nonprofit. When the Keith Lamont Scott shooting here had people literally in the streets in anger over all sorts of government inequalities, she said, okay, we're going to pick housing. We're going to see what we can do about it. And again, a story that I didn't really know until I did the book research.
So one of the things that I think can be discouraging about talking about solutions and things that might help with the problem of housing affordability is just the scale. You know, by some estimates, Charlotte is more than, I think, about 34,000 units short of having enough housing affordable for lower income people to meet all the demand. How do you think about that scale, which, you know, is so much bigger than a lot of the projects you're writing about, which are 50 units, 100 units, 150 units. It just seems, you know, almost Sisyphean in some ways.
You got to start somewhere. And knowing that there are 150 good examples here in Charlotte gives me hope in that direction. The I think a idea that that didn't come to pass with scattered site housing, the thing that Charlotte was so good at in the 70s and 80s. Harvey Gantt, who was mayor at that point, says that he takes people around to some of these areas and shows them what was built, and they don't know it's public housing. And despite that, the pushback against affordable housing near me has continued unabated. We are no longer building the barrack-style public housing. We're not even building scattered site housing, where it was 50 units in an apartment complex that was part of a neighborhood along Providence Road or wherever. We're now building areas that are completely mixed, pretty much undetectable from the street, and they work great. If you haven't been to Brightwalk off of Statesville Avenue, it is just a delightful place. If you're around South Park Mall, go to Ashley Lane, and that's a little street of boutiques and apartments and offices and affordable housing. So it is a huge problem, but you got to start somewhere.
So you've been in Charlotte for a while, and you've seen attitudes, I think, evolve. Do you find in your research and when you're out talking to people in the communities that there's still as much fear and pushback? Because my experience, especially as a development reporter in Charlotte, is that people hate when anything is built near them, and they probably hate it a little more if it's got the word affordable in front of it.
Yeah. And that's well said. We have been kind of coached for much of our lives to assume that any land use that's different from what I see right in front of me in my neighborhood, any land use coming in, it could be a school, it could be a church, it could be sports fields, or it could be new housing, multifamily housing. We are a little paranoid, and I use that word exact. We are unreasonably fearful that private property values will degrade when there's any sort of change. And it is really fascinating to see that development in the South Park area, which is actually a redevelopment of earlier scattered site housing in which they increased the number of units. And there was virtually no pushback. So when people get the actual experience of living around affordable housing, they're no more worried about it than the people in Myers Park or Plaza Midwood or Dilworth were back in the day.
And one thing that, excuse me, I think is tough about this problem is that there is a segment of the market that is the teachers, firefighters, nurses, which developers and local policymakers really like to point to and say, hey, this is who's going to be in the mixed income community. Who doesn't want to live next to a firefighter? Who doesn't want to live next to a teacher?
Right.
And that's true. You know, it can be difficult to find housing if you're making a teacher's salary. But then there's a lot of need at the very low income side of things, people who are making, minimum wage, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000. Maybe they're on disability. Maybe they, have had tough life circumstances and can't work. And a lot of the stuff that we develop in Charlotte, a lot of the housing we develop, a majority of it that is subsidized, is targeted for the teacher, firefighter, nurse, much less. And I think there's much more pushback towards the very low income spectrum. And frankly, those people probably need help in different ways. What do you think about how we approach that? And what did you find in researching this book that might offer some hints of solutions?
Well, let me give you a specific instance that opened my eyes. I have a friend that I play music with who is a Vietnam veteran and who is living on Social Security. He's a little bit older than I am, and that's his economic circumstance. And I haven't talked with him recently about what Social Security pays per month now, but the last I looked, it was about $1,100. And if you multiply that by 12 months, get your calculator out, it is not very much at all. And he was able to live in an area at the edge of the Charlotte metro where he was paying, I can't remember, $600-700 a month for an apartment. Somebody from New York came in, bought the apartment, put in granite countertops, and doubled the rent. And at $600-700 a month, it's really scary, you know, if you're getting $1,100 a month for your income. But at double that rent, it's impossible. And so we've got a lot of people who are, you know, in this impossibility situation. One way to deal with that, which we haven't talked about here yet, is income. Our minimum wage froze in, I think, 2009 and has not increased, whereby rents have gone up by almost 100%. And so we could increase the minimum wage. There are proposals to have supplemented income for folks at the bottom of the economic ladder. Those are all things that seemed pretty weird a few years ago, but the folks who are trying to hire the nurses and the teachers and deal with the grandmothers and grandfathers on Social Security, they're starting to talk about that.
Yeah, and the city of Charlotte, their minimum wage for municipal employees, I believe, is going to go to $24 an hour next fiscal year, which, I mean, if you back up a decade, that sounds really high. If you back up two decades, that sounds probably, you know, out of the realm of possibility. How about Section 8 vouchers and other means to help people pay for housing?
There you go.
My understanding is that a large majority of people who are eligible for that aid don't receive it, but that seems like another lever that could be activated more quickly than building new apartments from the ground up.
Yeah. And that's part of this smorgasbord of tools that we have. Section 8 is actually more important for housing low-income folks than is the purpose-built apartment complexes that I mostly focus on. It was also a Reagan-era thing. Let's work with the market, give a voucher that the landlord will use to supplement this 30% of your income, and that way you can afford to live anywhere in Charlotte. Great idea. Landlords don't have to take them. And very few Section 8 vouchers are used in high opportunity neighborhoods. And so that's an issue. Another big issue is that the current budget bill that's being argued in Congress in May and June of 2025 calls for a 40% cut in those kind of housing assistance. And if that happens, I think we're going to see a lot more people at the street corners and in tents down in the valley.
And already, you mentioned people can't use those everywhere they want. It's up to the landlord. And if people are not able to find a place that could take them in, I believe, 120 days, they lose that, right?
Yes. Yeah. And so we have... layers of problems. You said that it's a tough thing to get your arms around. I don't think that it will ever be solved in the way that a crisis is solved. It's more a chronic thing, and I appreciate your giving me that language. But it really is a crisis if you look at urgency. This is something that is affecting everyone around us.
So as you finished this book and pushed it off into the world, did you end up in an optimistic or a pessimistic place about the future?
More optimistic than I'd been. I, like my friend who said, affordable housing, that's going to be a short book, was impressed at the thought and the accomplishment that generations of people have put into this. We've got tools that work. But we need to be thinking about the big picture.
And that's Dr. Tom Hanchett, local historian and author of Affordable Housing in Charlotte, What One City's History Tells Us About America's Pressing Problem. That's out now wherever you buy books. Tom, thanks for the hour.
Thank you so much.
I'm Eli Portillo, in for Mike Collins, and you've been listening to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.